Hello, I'm Justin Katz. It's Friday, August 28th, and this is Last Impressions number 48. Yes, Last Impressions is back, and I'm cheating. I'm picking up my numbers where I left off. If you didn't pay attention a couple years ago, I can't believe it's that long ago, I used to do a weekly podcast on OceanStateCurrent.com called Last Impressions. And for various reasons, it took a lot of time and my priorities went elsewhere. I stopped doing it. But now with the new media landscape, I feel like I got to get back into it, and Facebook Live seems to be the thing to do. So there's some debate whether I should have started back at 1, but I'm going to go ahead with 48. It seems more impressive anyway. But one of the main things that made me think of doing this again, of getting this back up and going again, and all this technology. And by the way, I'm using some new technology to me. I've spent a lot of time playing with it, but I could mess up. So I'm going to take it slow if I have a little bit of slack on this. But one of the reasons I wanted to start doing this is the events of the past several months, they've really put a spotlight, I think, on how much our country and our state need an alternative media. You can look at COVID-19 and the media's fear-mongering. In particular, the one I keep coming back to in conversation and in writing is WPRI had charts, and it's an ongoing debate about, do you show the number of deaths from COVID-19 on the day they reported or the day they happened? And for several weeks, they were showing when they were reported, and it looked like deaths were climbing, but they weren't. They were going down. So the fear-mongering, there needs to be alternative to that. And especially lately with the Black Lives Matter riots and the Black Lives Matter rallies and the Antifa riots, the mostly peaceful but fiery riots, that begs for an alternative media. And I've had reason to really kind of personally feel the problem here, because the news media, they're not doing their job really protecting people. So some of you may have seen on OceanStateCurrent.com or heard about John DiPietro was covering, I don't know, riots. It's not quite a riot or a rally. It's more of an action or a strike. Some protesters, Antifa supposedly, presumably, tried to blind him with one of those green lasers and actually did some damage to his eyes. Now, that is a real step up in how these things are going. And it's very dangerous. And that's really, the media is supposed to protect us from that sort of thing. Now, what I mean by that, so John DiPietro was at a, and so sorry to keep referring to John, but he's kind of at the center of this in Rhode Island. But he's been covering the governor's press conferences on the COVID-19 stuff, and there had been an event online with the school education commissioner and the governor. And somebody had asked a question, I don't want to get into that side topic, about who was afraid and whether people were getting sick and that kind of thing. And somebody, a principal, I think, at one of the schools had tweeted something out. And so John was at this press conference and asked about it, completely 100% a legitimate question. Somebody in official capacity asked about something, and here at a press conference where you're supposed to ask, the press gets to ask questions of the elected officials and appointed officials, John asked a question. But after that, Steph Machado, who's a journalist for Channel 12, that's WPRI, she tweeted out to her audience, she said, "I don't normally address rumors, don't want to amplify, but since it was asked on live TV for everyone to hear," and then she goes on to correct what she thought was John's error. Now, think about this for a second. Not only was this a shot at John DiPietro, a shot at his asking questions, and putting aside debates over the question, what she was doing was acting as if the fact that her station was covering this event really gave her some authority over the questions that were asked. I mean, that's kind of normally they don't run press conferences live, right? So other journalists can ask whatever they want. But here's a journalist going after another journalist, acting like he took advantage of her regal airwaves to get his message out or something like that. And it seemed really inappropriate to me. And then shortly, not long after this, and in fact the day after John was attacked with the laser. WPRO talk host Tara Granahan, she kind of joined in on the anti-DePietro chorus, and she tweeted out, without naming anybody, "Dear young ladies of local media, please don't let any has-been basement dwellers glom onto your beautiful selves, talent, and popularity. Ignoring them feels so much better. Trust me." So that was Tara Granahan's thoughts. Now, as I said, this was the day after John was attacked. And the kind of passive-aggressive, not naming the, quote, has-been basement dweller, I asked Tara on Twitter, do you have anybody in mind? Is there somebody you're thinking of with this attack? And she went after me, saying I was trying to glom onto her fame by get myself more Twitter followers because I went after the famous Tara Granahan on Twitter. She said, get off my Twitter stream. And I apologized because I had assumed she knew how Twitter works. Like you tweet and it goes on my stream and I respond as if it's on my stream. It's a technical, difficult thing. But this was the day after somebody, a left-wing activist, had attacked John, trying to blind him. I had to jump into it. What's interesting here, just as a side note, is so you've got Steph Machado, as if the airways are her, and it's inappropriate for John DePietro to ask a question of the governor at a press conference because that'll go out to her audience. And you've got Tara Granahan here, possessive of her Twitter stream, as if she runs that and owns that, and you know, anybody who wants to do anything to get any kind of conversation with her is just trying to get her audience to like them, I guess. The key point here, though, is that these are journalists encouraging each other to ignore people, to ignore other people who collect the news and who make the news, to ignore them. You know, memo to journalists, you're supposed to cover people you don't like. You're supposed to present a balanced story of what's actually happening in the world to the public. That's your job. That's how people understand what's going on in the world and can make good decisions themselves. If you know, in the news media, the supposedly unbiased news media like WPRI, now that's especially true, but even if you're a talk host, an opinion host on Tara Granahan, like Tara Granahan, you're supposed to convey the information to the public and address arguments you dislike, not only because it better informs them, but because that's what makes it interesting. You don't brush off people you don't like just because you don't. You address them. You bring them on air. You talk about the ideas. When you don't do that, and what we're seeing form here, and what's really, really dangerous, is called a blacklist. Now, journalists used to be against blacklists. They used to talk about the communist blacklist in Hollywood. That used to be a cliche, blacklist, just the word blacklist. You're not even allowed to say blacklist anymore. Well, now that's what they're forming. They're saying, if we don't agree with you, we're not going to give you our airtime, our Twitter stream, our attention, so that people ignore you. Now, this is not just a point of principle. Once journalists decide that they're going to ignore people they don't like or they disagree with, and let's be honest here, by one measure or another, those people that they don't like are going to tend to be disfavored minorities. Once journalists do that, they open the door for escalation, they open a door for attacks and silence, and they open a door, in a word, for fascism. So this made me reflect about, you know, the many years I've been kind of doing this stuff, mostly as an amateur, even now, as you can see with this video, pretty much as an amateur anyway. But my tendency has always been, when they've come my way, to laugh off threats. Because, you know, people say things. I know conservative writer Jonah Goldberg has talked about how when the internet first became a thing, he would get emails, anti-Semitic emails, because Goldberg's a Jewish name. Jonah Goldberg's pretty Jewish, especially Jewish, as he says. But he would get emails attacking him in anti-Semitic terms. And every now and then he would respond and people would write back, "Oh, I didn't even think you actually read these things." So, you get a threat, you kind of write it off. All right, this is just somebody blowing off steam. They think they're playing. It's almost like kids taunting each other on a playground. But I don't know if I can do that anymore. So early on in Rhode Island's Black Lives Matter issue with the rallies, I think it was the night of the riot around the mall, I had tweeted out something saying this, kind of taking it all in. I tweeted out something, and a guy named Dennis tweeted this. It says, "The only thing we didn't get to tonight. We'll catch you next time." Now, if you don't recognize it, this is a photo of some American contractors, military contractors, I believe, who were murdered, dragged through the streets, and hung from a bridge in Fallujah. So what this Dennis guy is saying is, that's on our list. We're going to get you. We'll get, like, you know, we're going to blind John DePietro. We're going to get you and kill you and hang you from a bridge. Normally, I would have laughed this off. You know, it's a meme. It's whatever. All right, this is some guy. And you know, frankly, he had the decency to make his Twitter stream private after I started responding and didn't just cower in a corner. So what's of particular concern here, though, is this guy is not just, and I found his last name. I'm not going to, you know, dox him on here. But this guy is not just some hothead on Twitter. He's a member of Common Defense, which is an organizer for Common Defense, which is a progressive veterans organization. He was involved with the Bernie Sanders campaign. This is an organized guy in the movement, in the progressive cause, not just some schmo who should know better. This is where I get back to what I'm concerned about here. For the past few decades, one of the reasons I've been able to laugh this stuff off is because once you've got even a small audience, I've known, and those who are going after me, I presumably have known, that if their behavior got bad enough, I could expose it and be counterproductive. So if you really, you know, do something like threaten to hang me dead from a bridge, I could, you know, make hay of that and get local media attention, maybe get national media attention. That was part of the safety that I've always felt. And a lot of us in this kind of activity, this kind of work, have always said, you know, if you get the threat, and you see this on Twitter all the time, if you get the threat, tweet it out immediately. Copy it, scan it, take a picture of it, put it up, make it news, because that's your protection. And it creates, that fact creates disincentive for people to go after us too much. Because if you get out of hand, you're going to help us. You're going to raise our profile. You're going to make your own cause look bad. Now it's not clear that's an effective tool anymore. In fact, it's getting pretty clear in the other direction. As long as the person doing the attacking is a progressive, they'll get away with it. And that's true whether we're talking about, I mean, this isn't just a journalist, activist kind of a thing. If you look at who gets to wear a mask, who gets to congregate, if you're having a backyard barbecue, the governor's going to send her state police force after you. If you're having a riot, well, you know, she'll come out and join you without a mask and put her arms around you. This is the double standard that's out there, and it's getting dangerous. Now, I'm not sure exactly what has changed. I noticed, for one, a large change in attitude of local media with the election of Donald Trump. So there may be some Trump derangement syndrome, perhaps has gone so far as almost an unofficial memorandum that went around the media and said, yeah, we're doing things differently. In any event, it's all tied up with the division of our times. And a big part of it, I think, is the younger generation of reporters. And this, I think, is a lot of the explanation for what's going on at WPRI. The younger generation of reporters, they've been completely brought up from kindergarten through their journalism degree on left-wing indoctrination, basically. And they've understood their mission to be activists on the, quote, right side of history. In fact, just today, I saw somebody retweeting a journalist from Channel 10, WJAR, who I guess it looks like just before she went to bed, tweeted out something to the effect of, social justice is not a position, it's not an opinion, it's just common decency. So that's what they think. Their political view is just the facts. It's just common decency. It's just being good. It's not their perspective. They don't have to offer any other perspectives. They don't have to try to be unbiased and give another side. That's just decency, and they're going to be decent people. And what they're doing is actually the opposite. It's absolutely shameful. Real journalists shouldn't make decisions based on who their subjects are. Their decisions should be what they cover, all of that, and I wrote about this actually today on theoceanstatecurrent.com, all of their decisions should be based on what's happening, whoever it is, so the public can understand what's going on and the public can make good decisions. These days, journalists seem to think that Their job is to lead the public to the decisions that they, the journalists, think are the good ones. And you have to wonder, if this escalates, do they even care? I mean, it can definitely escalate. I think of Minnesota, bizarrely, the land of nice people. Minnesota is becoming a really good example of all this. One of them, there was a candidate in Minnesota who is running for office, obviously as a candidate, and he led a Black Lives Matter mob into a suburban neighborhood of his a competing candidate, who I take it is a member of the police union there. And so this mob goes out, clogs up the street. You might have seen videos of this, shouts at neighbors. One of the neighbors' daughters was in the parking lot, the driveway, like this the whole time, just disbelieving what was going on in her neighborhood. And then the part that really should be the headline is this Black Lives Matter mob hung effigies, piñatas, of the guy they were going after and his wife, who's a local TV journalist out there, and beat them. You don't get much less subtle than this. This is escalation. It goes from this to beating people. And as it happens, we can go to Minnesota for another example. Now, I'm talking here about a Minnesota journalist named Rebecca Brannon. She works for an alternative news source called Alpha News. She's a woman, a young woman of Mexican descent. And this mob chased her down the street for 5-10 minutes. Presumably she's walking backwards so she can film them again. The video is your protection, your record. There were three women here who were the main culprits. And what's interesting here, observe, and as I said before, these are not spontaneous things. This is planned and orchestrated. Note the men in the background, maybe they're throwing things, maybe they're not, but they're just sort of menacing, keeping that periphery. Every now and then one of them step forward and almost gentlemanly say, this isn't going to go well for you. You should leave. But that was what they did. Now it did escalate even from this intimidating scene. And by the way, while I'm looking at this, every now and then, if you watch on the Twitter streams of the local journalists, they'll talk about how you shouldn't, somebody will say something rude, presumably sexist, or just something generally not nice to a woman journalist or something like that. And you'll see Twitter all over, it'll go national. Oh, women journalists shouldn't have to put up with this. Well, here's a woman journalist putting up with being chased down the street by an angry mob threatening her. But it did get worse. I'm going to play a video. I should preface this with, there's a definite language warning here. It's impossible to give you any video from this that doesn't have F-bombs in it. So if that's a problem, hit mute or until the video's over, or click away. But here it is.
Let me walk to my car.
So note again, the guy here keeping the perimeter, making her feel surrounded. There's some more guys in the background. There's another one to her side over here.
I'm trying to give you coverage. My car is that way.
There's a guy.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
I'm going to beat your ass, she said.
Get away from me. Yeah, I mean, what? Get away from me.
Now, apparently, from what I've read, what happened there was one of her assaulters, presumably one of those women, grabbed her phone and threw it in a fountain. The phone was ruined, but she was able to retrieve her phone and get the memory card out of that phone, which contained that video, which is very important because, again, if she hadn't found that video, I wouldn't be talking about that. This wouldn't be an issue we could talk about. This wouldn't be something that happened to her that was documented. This would just be, another line in a story in some blogger's website somewhere. So that's what was so important about being able to get this kind of information out. You know, I think about one story I have flagged just to write a quick post about. It talks about somewhere in the country, deep in the Midwest somewhere, where there are, they found a handful of racist flyers somewhere. And that was in a Rhode Island newspaper. That's what happens with the narrative the news wants to promote. Anywhere in the country, if you have, in a country of 330 million people, if you had five incidences in our entire, this country that spans a continent and then some, five instances of a dozen racist flyers, that would feel like a huge trend, because the media would play it up like they're doing with these shootings. But we don't see that over and over again with these attacks on journalists. And locally, I might have missed it, but nobody has covered John DePietro being attacked with a laser. That's inexcusable. And that's why I wanted to start this weekly live blog again. Well, now it's a live blog with this weekly podcast thing again. Because, you know, it's time for the old promise of blogs to be fulfilled and put the final nail in the coffin of the legacy media, because they deserve it. They're not doing their jobs. You know, it's not for no reason that one of the most lucrative career paths right now for journalists is to hop out of journalism and into government, on a government gravy train as PR people. And it's always with Democrats, right? And if they don't go from there, they go into news media, and we see their opinions there. We see them on Twitter. We see when they say they're proud to participate in rallies. We see it on CNN with the fiery but mostly peaceful protests, and also CNN saying violent protest, and then 15 seconds later, somebody had cut out the word violence. They're crafting a narrative. It's not their job. It's harmful. It's dangerous. That needs to stop. And journalists need their career path changed. They need their attitude changed. And they need to their respect for their role in our society has to change, too. We give them special priorities. They ought our special privileges, special abilities, special parking spots. I've got the pass in my car. But they need to be doing the job they're hired for. And until that happens, their credibility needs to change, and the public needs to support alternatives. And I'm going to be trying to bring you some of that every week. Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity, we're doing that as well. More and more content online, videos, audio, writing. That's where we've got to go, and we're going to need the support. We're going to need the support not only for financial reasons, but also because that's how we protect ourselves. And so, you know, the financial, it all comes together. If we got financial reasons, we can buy guns for our concealed carry permits and maybe protect ourselves with something more than a cell phone. For now, it's Justin Katz signing off for Last Impressions 48.